Hello, this is the podcast for October 18, and it was class number 16. And now we've moved away from discussing duty and breach. Negligence is now taken for granted. There's a negligent action, and we're, since last class, we've been talking about liability for that negligence. So we've moved away. If we were on our schedule of elements for cause of action for negligence, we're on now cause in fact. And cause in fact is usually not that big of a deal to show. It's a question of fact. That's why we talk about, have the word cause in fact in there, or actual cause as opposed to proximate cause, which is also called legal causation. But cause in fact is a question of fact, and as such, it relates to reasonable care, which was also a question of fact. So your job is to not make a decision yourself, but to evaluate the facts to determine with whether the facts lead to sufficient facts in order to send to the jury. But cause in fact is not usually a problem. I'm driving negligently down the street. I hit you. You have an injury. The cause in fact of that injury was my negligent driving. That's not usually a problem. So cause in fact can be solved and disposed of very easily by saying, but for my negligent driving, you wouldn't have this broken leg. So the but-for test of cause in fact generally gets you out of any sort of problem. However, when cause in fact is a problem, it's a really big problem. So what we're going to be talking about today are cases where but-for doesn't work and providing enough evidence for cause in fact to get you to the jury is a difficult thing. And that we find those in toxic tort cases, medical cases where there's medical proof issues. Those are very frequently difficult situations. Go sit in the little room, if you will. I'm finishing up a podcast. So just open the door with that, and you can sit in there and work for a while, if you will. So those are very frequently very hard to show. And other tests beyond just the but-for test become important. So Zickowitz is the case that we looked at first. No problem with negligence. Negligent overdose, but the important thing in Zukovich was to show that the overdose itself, not the prescription for Danicrin, which wasn't negligence due, but the overdose itself was the cause of the death, was the cause of the PPH. And here we there was a lot of talk about medical testimony and getting, showing medical testimony and the role of the judge in admitting medical testimony. Just know the stuff that's in the slides. This isn't something that I really expect you to know to great detail, the differences between the tests that we use to get evaluate medical testimony and getting it admitted into evidence. Daubert v. Fry, very important if you're practicing, of lesser importance right now, but just know that we had experts here who were testifying, and neither of them could say that but for the overdose, our plaintiff wouldn't have gotten, or our decedent wouldn't have gotten this PPH. Why couldn't they say that? Because nobody had ever done any tests with this an overdose of Danicrin to this level. But what the experts were able to say was that they felt to a reasonable medical certainty that the overdose was the cause. They eliminated the other reasons for the they eliminated the other reasons for PPH, and they said the timing was right. What's this all called? Circumstantial evidence. We've seen the role of circumstantial evidence before, when we saw our questions around constructive notice. We've seen that circumstantial evidence is perfectly good to allow the jury to provide an inference. The inference was of negligence before. Now our inference is of causation. So because we're dealing with questions of fact, circumstantial evidence is allowed. Then we moved over to a different type of injury, and this is loss of a chance, loss of the opportunity to be saved. We see here in New Mexico, loss of a chance itself was a new kind of tort for them. What was the injury? The injury wasn't that the leg had to be amputated. It's in our Albert's case, it wasn't that the leg had to be amputated. It was that our plaintiff lost the chance that the leg could have been saved. And as we saw here, any amount of chance will do, even if there was a 30% chance, even if there was a 20% chance. What our plaintiff had to show is that there were sufficient facts that a reasonable jury could find more likely than not that the negligent act on the part of the defendants caused the plaintiff to lose whatever chance it was, 20% or 30% or whatever percentage, that the leg could have been saved. So our burden of proof is still the same, 51%, more likely than not. It's just that the injury has changed. The injury isn't the amputation. The injury is the loss of the chance. The real issue here was, what should the recovery be? Should it be less than 100%? And here the court said, well, a proportional recovery is adequate. Proportional recovery works fine. They shouldn't get 100% of their damages. And I maintain that that makes no sense. If the injury is the loss of the chance, they've had a loss of a chance. And most courts will agree that proportional recovery and loss of a chance cases is not satisfactory. Then we talked about multiple defendants. We started talking about joint and several liability. Joint and several liability allows one of a multiple defendant. If you have a number of negligent defendants, you can't apportion out the injuries. You can't apportion the cause. Joint and several liability will allow one of a negligent group of defendants to be liable for their own, whatever they caused, and the whole. And that's what you can see. Jointly liable for yourself and for everybody else. Severally only liable for yourself. You can tell that's a great thing for the plaintiff. The plaintiff doesn't have to. The plaintiff doesn't have to get all of the defendants in order to get their whole recovery. Getting one, you get the whole recovery. Then that defendant has to go find the other ones to get some contribution. We also talked about ways that multiple defendants can be held liable for the torts of others. We already saw one way. That was respondeat superior. Other ways, we talked about it briefly and go over it more in the book because the book talks about it. Concerted action, concurrent action. All ways that you can be held liable for the torts of others. And again, jointly and severally, if that's part of your, if that's part of your jurisdiction. Again, concerted action, concurrent action, and also indivisible injury, that you can't divide up the injury. So distinguish between apportionment of fault that comes in at the damages stage and apportionment of cause. And then talking about multiple defendants, we finished up with the Summers v. Tice case, alternative liability. Why here under alternative liability did they end up switching the burden of proof? Because we had two negligent defendants, and only one of them was responsible, but the plaintiff was the last person to know which one. Plaintiff couldn't prove but for, but when there are two negligent defendants, one of whom was responsible for the injury, and but for would get them both off. Court says under the rule under Summers v. Tice is switch the burden of proof, so the defendant then has the burden of proof. We then talked about this as this whole idea of the problems with but for letting a negligent defendant off the hook when we know that the defendant had a great role in the causation, but plaintiff can't show that but for, can't show even 51%. It's 50-50 under Summers v. Tice. Plaintiff can't show 51% that the defendant is the but for cause. Courts have adopted, when but for fails you, many courts have adopted what's termed the substantial factor test. Substantial factor will allow, when but for fails, will allow a plaintiff to hold a negligent defendant responsible, or at least get you to the jury, when you have less than 100% showing. But for is 100%, but for the negligent defendant, this injury wouldn't have happened. Doesn't change the burden of proof. The burden of proof is still more likely than not. It's just saying more likely than not, but for the negligent behavior of the defendant, the injury wouldn't have happened. Substantial factor just sets it a little bit less at this 100%. So you still have to show by a more likely than not, have to have evidence more likely than not, our negligent defendant was the substantial factor in causing the injury. So substantial factor is an alternative to the but-for test, just sets the standard a little bit lower down on the equation, but certainly never less than a minimum requirement. So substantial factor, you can see, you know, it's close to reasonable certainty, less than but-for, but still high up on the equation. So read over the material. It will be clearer, I think, after the discussion. And next class, we're going to talk about another way that when but-for fails, another way of showing causation When but-for fails, we have multiple defendants, another way of showing causation, and that's our Heimovitz, the Eli Lilly.